Good morning. This is Focus 580, hour number two of our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Producing the program, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, Henry Frain is at the controls this morning. In this part of Focus 580, we'll be talking about a structural change, very significant structural change, that is now going on in the American housing market. It is a major shift in the way that many Americans want to live and work. And our guest for the program is Christopher Lineberger. He is a land use strategist, a developer, a teacher, a consultant, and an author. And we'll be talking about the movement of people away from suburban living back into urban living. He says that over the past six decades, government policies have tilted toward one form of development, and that we know quite well. That's the drivable suburb. However, he also says that today there are growing numbers of Americans who are looking for a new type of community, a place where they can live and work and play all within easy walking distance. So this morning in this show, we'll talk a little bit about some of the things that real estate and financial communities can do to meet the growing demand for walkable urbanism. That's something that he deals with in a book that he has authored. And the title of his book is The Option of Urbanism. It's published by the Island Press. The subtitle, Investing in a New American Dream. And if you're interested, you can seek that book out. Our guest, Christopher Lineberger, is currently a visiting fellow at the Brookings Institution in Washington, D.C., where he's doing research on ways that cities can develop walkable urban characters. He's also a professor of practice and director of the Graduate Real Estate Development Program at the University of Michigan, and also he is founding partner of Arcadia Land Company. That's a real estate development firm that has active projects in a number of places, including Independence, Missouri, and in the Philadelphia metro area. He's written articles for publications in a number of places, the Atlantic Monthly, the Wall Street Journal, Urban Land Magazine, has also done a lot of talking and interviews on the subject. And again, you might want to take a look at this book that just recently has been published, The Option of Urbanism, Investing in a New American Dream. He's talking with us this morning from Washington, from Brookings, and we're glad that he could give us some of his time. Questions, of course, are welcome, always are. The only thing that we ask of callers is that when people call in, they try to keep comments and questions brief just so we can keep moving along and get in as many different people as possible. But certainly callers are welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. At any point here, you have questions, calls are certainly welcome. Mr. Lineberger, hello.
How are you?
I'm fine, thanks. And yourself?
Doing very well, and I'm particularly pleased to be on this radio station since when I was younger, I would drive across country, and this radio station was a beacon of civilization for hundreds of miles.
Well, I appreciate the kind words. We're still trying it. Some days, I don't know how well we do. But anyway, I'm really glad that you could spend some time with us. Just how significant are the numbers of people we're talking about that maybe either are starting out, they're saying the city and a particular kind of city life is what they're looking for, or maybe we actually have people who have lived in suburban areas that are choosing to relocate. How significant a movement are we talking about?
Rather significant, and especially when you look on the margins, when you look on what's going to be taking place over the next 10 to 20 years. A couple background pieces of information that's important to note. One is that the built environment, which is our houses, our office buildings, our retail, the university campus, state office buildings, when you add in the infrastructure to that, so all of our buildings and all of our infrastructure represents 35% of the assets of our country. That's 35% of our wealth. That if you took all the New York Stock Exchange companies and all the NASDAQ companies and took their capitalized value, added them up and multiplied them by two, the value of the built environment is more. So we're dealing with the largest asset class in the entire economy. So it is significant no matter what happens to it. But the second thing is that over the last 50, 60 years, we've only legally allowed one form of the built environment to be built. The other form, walkable urbanism, was effectively illegal in this country. It was not allowed by our zoning laws, and we massively subsidized the alternative that we wanted at that point, drivable suburban development.
How did that decision come about to favor that, to favor the suburban environment that is so heavily car dependent that we have come to know, and a lot of people maybe grew up that way, or a lot of people are living that way now?
I believe it's a reflection of the underlying economy of the country. And so in the mid-20th century, when you take a look at the industrial economy that was the basis of how we made a living in this country, about a third of all jobs, direct and indirect, were in the car-oriented business, that you were either making cars or making petroleum or building roads or pumping oil or building tires. And the vast array of services that related to the car-based transportation system was literally a third of all jobs. So it only made sense that as you saw the USA in your Chevrolet, that you were also making yourself wealthier. So there is this yin and yang, this connection between how we wanted to live our lives and how we made our living. And we're now in this 21st century, post-industrial, knowledge-based economy. And so it's natural that how we build the built environment will be a reflection of how we make our living.
Hmm. And I guess I find myself wondering, here we have an example where the built environment was designed and constructed around our commitment to personal transportation, and basically in the form of the automobile. Is it true that in the past that modes of transportation have always helped to dictate the shape of the built environment, or is there something about this that's different than what's gone before?
No, when you look at the 5,500 years that we've been building cities, that transportation has always driven the form that that development has taken. And so a walkable, horse-driven built environment resulted in high-density, walkable urban cities. As we introduced trains, and particularly commuter trains, and then railroads, we began to see some decentralization take place. But the important thing to note is that around each of those rail transit stops, it was just as high density as in the downtowns, because once you got there, you still had to walk home. So it still had to be tight, high density, walkable urban, but just scattered along a rail line or two or three. And then as we introduced cars, it obviously allowed for a fundamentally different way of building the built environment that we had never seen in the 5,500 years that we've been building cities. It was a radical new shift in how we invested that 35% of our wealth in the built environment. And I've got to emphasize, we wanted to do this. Nobody held a gun to our head. This was something that we fantasized about, that it began to become the basis of the American dream. And to a certain extent, we're now seeing that replicated worldwide. I mean, in Mumbai, India, somebody who grows up in a high-density urban situation, given a chance to live in the suburbs, you bet they'll just run out there. And most of the new immigrants coming to our country today, many of them are moving immediately to the suburbs. And it's because they've never had that opportunity. Well, it's just a matter of the pendulum swinging, and now the pendulum for most Americans, not all, but most Americans, is beginning to swing back and demanding the alternative that we've not had for 50, 60 years.
Yeah. When we made the move to the drivable suburb, did people have to be sold on the advantages? Because after all, this would be it would be living differently. It would be a different kind of housing. It would be a different relationship to your neighbors. It would be breaking you off from public transport if that's what you'd used before. And even if you had wanted to walk, it would have meant that there was no way that you were going to walk to the store. Your children probably weren't going to be able to walk to school. You certainly couldn't walk to work even if you wanted to. Did people have to be persuaded that was a good thing, or were when they were sort of shown the picture of this ideal suburban lifestyle, did they right away say, yeah, I'm ready to go?
I think it's more the latter, that they were shown something new. We're Americans, after all. We like things new. And that they were shown this image of this, you know, sylvan pasture that you could own yourself, even though was only a quarter acre, and that it really began to be a common motivation throughout the entire society. And I always like to look, of course, at the popular culture to understand what that says about us, because the popular culture, and in particular TV shows, have been thoroughly researched. And to me, they're really a reflection of basic American desires. So, you know, in January of 1957, Lucy moved with her husband out from New York City out to suburban Connecticut. And that show, Fred and Ethel came out to visit them from the city. And, of course, they had a hilarious situation out there, getting lost in all that stuff. Well, 3 weeks later, Fred and Ethel moved out to Connecticut. And that repeated a very common popular cultural image of the time. Back then, you know, 75% of metropolitan dwellers lived in the city. But they were shown a new way of living, and they flocked to it. Well, today the same thing's happening, that it starts with Cheers and Seinfeld back in the 90s, Sex and the City and all the rest. And all of a sudden, particularly younger people, folks that are in their 20s and 30s, the so-called millennial generation, saw this image that Jerry Seinfeld portrayed. And having been brought up in the suburbs, they said, that's how I want to live. I am bored to tears with the sterile suburbs. So that's just one of the popular cultural signposts that the culture is changing and people are asking for choice.
Our guest in this hour of focus is Chris Leinberger. He is a land use strategist and developer, also a teacher, consultant, writer. He's interested in alternative methods of building the built environment right now. He is currently a visiting fellow at the Brookings Institution in Washington, D.C. He's also a professor of practice and director of the Graduate Real Estate Development Program at the University of Michigan, author of the book that you might want to look at if you'd like to pursue this further than we'll be able to do in this conversation. His book is The Option of Urbanism, Investing in a New American Dream, published by the Island Press this year. Questions are welcome. 333-9455. Toll free 800-222-9455. I'm interested in something that you said right at the beginning was in fact that for a long time, the kind of development that we're here talking about people wanting to move to, that is the walkable urban environment, you said it was not allowed. Not only it was not allowed, that it would because of zoning, it was illegal. In what way was that? What were the obstacles to doing that if you wanted to do that?
The obstacles were all riddled throughout zoning codes throughout the country. They take the form of very high parking ratios that you must provide on site. They take the form of setbacks from the sidewalks that you're not allowed to have your buildings come right up to the sidewalk. They take the form of height limits. You can only build one or two story buildings. And our zoning codes throughout the country and our parking codes and the way we build our streets basically dictate a only one form of building, which is low density suburban development, and it mandates very low densities that over the last 20-30 years, as we've added 1% to our population, in this country, we have tended to add between 8 and 12% land use consumption. And so the farmlands around Champaign-Urbana, as I've understood, are obviously getting consumed by low-density land use patterns. Mm-hmm. And that is a direct reflection of the laws that are on the books. And it makes illegal building anything high density in most cases, 90-95% of the jurisdictions throughout the country.
We have a caller here we'd like to bring into the conversation. Let me just mention again, questions, comments are certainly welcome. If you're in Champaign-Urbana, here where we are, 333-9455 is the number. We do also have a toll-free line, and that one's good anywhere that you can hear us. Use that if it would be a long-distance call, and we'll pay for the call. That's 800-222-9455. We have a caller here on our toll-free line, line number four. Hello.
Hello?
Yes.
Yes, a comment the gentleman made about the kids of today growing up in suburbia want to move back to, I guess, what you'd call high-density housing. Well, I have two daughters ages 21 and 16, and that's not what they want. I can't imagine why anybody, you know, there's a saying, good fences make good neighbors. I remember living in an apartment. You know, not being able to have any control of any kind about who was around you and sharing a paper-thin wall with somebody. I just don't see America going back to that. You know, I personally would drive just about the smallest car made rather than move back down into an urban environment. So I think it's a pipe dream. I don't think that, you know, gas could hit $10 a gallon. And I don't think America's going to go back to high density. At least I hope not. So anyway, that's my comment.
Well, okay. And you can pick up on that any way you like, Mr. Lineberg. I'm sure that there are some people who would agree with the caller and say, well, I don't want to live that way. You're not expecting that everyone is going to want to move back to the city.
Absolutely not. And it just goes back to the different strokes for a different folks. And that's the issue, of course, is to allow choice to be provided. And, you know, far be it from me to dictate any one way of folks having to live, though I would mention that that the low-density suburban development has been massively subsidized to the extent of 10 to 22 times what it actually, you know, that they would have to increase their costs for infrastructure 10 to 22 times to pay their own way. I'd prefer that nobody gets subsidized. I'm a free market kind of guy. And but obviously, you know, if somebody wants to pay $10 for gas to live in low density, bless them, that's just fine. But the demographics show that the growth in the population over the next 20-30 years will be demanding overwhelmingly walkable urban development, which is, again, not to say that, you know, people are going to flee the suburbs. And by the way, most of this development is going to be in the suburbs, the technical suburbs. This is not just a back-to-the-city kind of issue. I live here in D.C., and I moved here 3 years ago from Santa Fe, New Mexico. And one of the reasons I moved here is because, believe it or not, D.C. is becoming the model of how metropolitan America is developing because of the metro system here and its impact on urban form. There are 20 high-density walkable urban places in the metropolitan area, 10 more emerging. 20 years ago, there were two. So today, there's 20 with 10 more emerging. 70% of those places are in the suburbs. So it's not just a back-to-the-city movement, which partly it's that, but it's also that it's a reinvention of the suburbs. Mm-hmm. And going back to the caller's point, and again, goes to different strokes for different folks, my wife and I have five kids between us, and all five of them, they're in their 20s and 30s. The suburbs are not on their radar screen. Now, maybe they will be in the future, but at the moment, they couldn't imagine. So it's just a matter of offering up choice.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting. This makes me think about what's been going on here over the last maybe decade or so in the place where I grew up, which was a suburb northwest of Chicago. And there has been tremendous, tremendous development here. You've seen the kind of pattern that you see in a lot of places up in that part of the state where, and I'm sure the same thing happens elsewhere around the country, where old housing is knocked down to build much larger houses, you know, houses that that pretty much take up the entire footprint of the lot, this kind of thing that people seem to like or want right now. At the same time, though, near the downtown, and there is a nice downtown here, there has been a tremendous amount of building, condos, apartments, a lot of new retail. There are a lot of restaurants. There is a theater. There's actually a movie theater in the downtown, which is a big old theater, which is still in existence. It's served by a commuter rail line, and now I'm thinking that may in fact be the kind of thing that you're talking about. You could have an apartment or a condo near the downtown, and there would be a lot of places that you could go. I'm not sure that there would be a supermarket that you could walk to, but there are a lot of places there within walking distance. If you work downtown Chicago, you could walk to the train, you could walk to the movie theater, you could walk to a number of restaurants, and you could do a lot of retail shopping there within walking distance. And it's been very interesting to see what's happened with this place. As I say,
which town was that?
This is Park Ridge.
Mm-hmm.
It's been very interesting to see what's going on.
There are five different kinds of places where walkable urban development is taking place. There's downtowns that are coming back, and there's downtown adjacent places like, say, Lincoln Park in Chicago. Mm-hmm. But then you go out to the suburbs and you have suburban town centers like what you just referred to. But, of course, Evanston comes to mind as well. Uh-huh. As a place that its downtown is quite vital. It's seen, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars of development over the last 5-10 years. And then you go further to places that are redeveloping strip malls and redeveloping regional malls into high-density walkable urban places. And then finally, there's a fifth category, which is where on a greenfield location, you're seeing emerge a high-density walkable urban place. In the retail world, they're referred to as lifestyle centers, a strange term, but that's what they call them. So there's many different forms. And by the way, it is not just people living in thin-walled apartments. With a walkable urban place, there's lots of options and lots of different densities that you can live in a loft, you can live in a condo, you can live in an apartment right, you know, over the retail or within two or three blocks of all the intense retail. Or you can live in a townhouse, you know, three, four, five blocks away, or live in a single-family home, a tight, higher density single family home, but still within walking distance of the retail, of the maybe the train station, maybe of work. So lots of different options within these walkable urban places. It is not just this image of Ralph Cramden banging on the wall of his neighbors.
We have several other callers here to talk with. Let's do that next. We'll talk with somebody in Mahomet. This is line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Interesting show. I just wanted to say that right now I would love to move back to Champaign-Urbana. We live in Mahomet. We love it out here, but the gas is really costing a lot, you know, and a lot of my time is spent just going to and from work, and my husband, too. We have to have two cars and, you know, drive a lot. And the problem is the same problem, which is why we came out here, which is money. And that is that when we moved out to Mahomet, it was because we got a lot more house for the money out here and no crime, basically. And it seems like now they're downtown, they're developing downtown Champaign, but it's high rent places. And there's no place for us back in Champaign that we can afford. If we sold this house out here, we'd have to come up with another $60,000 to get the same level of living in Champaign. And I don't know, they just don't seem to have a place for us. And I'll just make that comment and listen on the air. Thank you.
All right. Well, that's something, in fact, I think you've written about that, that it's now the kind of urban environment that we're talking about some people looking for has become so desirable that there's actually now a premium people have to pay to have that kind of housing now.
I'm really glad that caller raised this point because it's a very, very important point. A, it demonstrates, just as you said, that there's a tremendous price premium. My research shows between 40% higher on a price per square foot basis and 200% higher, which is three times as much for a walkable urban condo or townhouse versus a drivable suburban single-family house that would be considered comparable to the same buyer. That's a huge premium. Part of the reason for the premium is that walkable urban product, housing product, is a much higher quality. It's high density, costs more to build. It's right up to the street, so you can't get away with spray-on sides. It's got to be real material. It just costs more to build high density. But that doesn't explain a 40 to 200% price premium. The other reason for it is the land cost. And the land is purely a reflection of supply and demand. It's purely a reflection of more demand than there is supply. So I never thought I'd get myself saying this, but it's a supply-side problem. We don't have enough supply. And that's that's the major reason that the prices are so high. However, a way to look at this, and again, the caller just perfectly framed this issue, that they have two cars. According to the AAA, the average American spent $7,800 per year per car to own and operate in 2007. And this is a Camry. This is a Ford Focus that was driven 15,000 miles per year. That $7,800 is after-tax earnings. So you have to earn $9,000 to $10,000, pay your taxes, and then pay the $7,800 to pay for that car. If you translated that into a mortgage, that mortgage would be between $120,000 and $150,000 extra mortgage if you dropped one car out of your household. If you shifted your spending from a depreciable asset, your car, to an appreciable asset, generally speaking, your house, that you'll be able to afford by much more than that $60,000 per year that the caller just referred to. But one of the people in the household have to either take transit or walk to work. And that is happening. A lot of people are demanding that and are finding a way to do that and shift their household spending. 100 years ago, households spent about 3% of their income on transportation. Today, we're spending on average 19%. It's the second highest category of household spending for the typical American household. If we could shift that from 19% down to 14%, like the Europeans do, by the way, and invest that money in our housing, and, oh, by the way, get some walking in and meet your neighbors and maybe deal with the obesity epidemic a bit, that people will be able to afford that higher price home in a walkable urban place.
We are a little bit past our midpoint here. Have another caller I'll get in just a moment, but I would like to introduce again our guest, Christopher Leinberger. He is a land use strategist, developer, consultant, writer. He is currently a visiting fellow at the Brookings Institution in Washington, D.C. He is also a professor of practice and director of the Graduate Real Estate Development Program at the University of Michigan. Also, he is founding partner of Arcadia Land Company, a progressive real estate development firm which has active projects going in Independence, Missouri, and in the Philadelphia metropolitan area. He's written articles for many publications, Atlantic Monthly, Wall Street Journal, Urban Land Magazine. He's also author of the book, The Option of Urbanism, Investing in a New American Dream, published by the Island Press. And questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Next, let's talk with someone in Champaign. This is line three. Hello.
Yeah, good morning. This is a very interesting program. I'd like to sort of respond to the woman in Mahomet. I live in West Champaign in a working-class neighborhood, and I think all the houses around here are under 100,000, and some of the lots are big. My lot happens to be 156 feet deep because, but there's a factory behind it, so you know, there are certain things you have to deal with, but factory also means there's not such density of people, and there's more wildlife, and there are bus lines near enough to use, and I also bike a lot. And then as far as the gentleman who said his 16 and 21-year-old didn't want to move to the city and live in paper-thin walls, there's a lot of development in smaller cities such as Champaign and Urbana. The mall that was built in Urbana probably 40 years ago is now calling itself Lincoln Square Village, and they're doing different kinds of development there. I'm not sure if they have housing. Do you know, David?
I don't think that they do. I thought at one point maybe the idea was that there might be. At present, I don't believe that there is.
Yeah, I know that they have a Health Alliance, I believe, moved in there, which is an HMO.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's not just retail. They're doing retail and office. But downtown Champaign is, you know, going gangbusters. And there are a lot of people who live in small cities who don't want to live, who want to be able to walk and bike and or take the bus. And I think Champaign-Urbana has a pretty high percentage of people who bike to work. We have our transportation system has won national prizes twice at least for they call it the best little transportation system. So it's not just downtown Chicago or downtown Detroit or downtown Seattle. There's a lot of development in smaller cities. And then there is an article in the Champaign News Gazette last week ago about the city discussing sustainability, because city governments and public bodies like that are also getting hit by the energy costs and are thinking of ways to conserve, and that all goes hand in glove with making things walkable and making things accessible.
Those are two very good points. Let me address the first one about small town America, which is that old image that we have of small town America is a walkable urban image. And I always like to use, in fact, I realize this will probably have you think that I'm a really tough professor, but I make my students up at the University of Michigan watch Back to the Future, the movie 20 years ago. And in that movie, it shows small town America, 1955 Hill Valley, which was really a 1920s artifact, that we didn't build much of anything in this country in the 1930s and into the 1940s due to the Depression and the war.
Right.
And so 1955 Hill Valley is really early 20th century American small town, and it was, completely walkable. There was cars, there was bicycles, there was walking, there were buses, and there were skateboards in the case of Michael J. Fox. And then you fast forward to 1985, Hill Valley, and the downtown's dead, only homeless there, X-rated movies, and all the life had been sucked out of it and went out to the mall. Well, that's classic America story, and it shows the two kinds of development options that we've had in this country. And I'm just saying that the research shows that the pendulum swinging back to want, for some people, not all people, a downtown Hill Valley of 1955. Going to the point about sustainability, and this is some research that'll be coming out from Brookings towards the end of the year, but the preliminary numbers have been pushed as far as the greenhouse gas emissions of walkable urban development versus drivable suburban. And the numbers are pretty surprising, that a drivable suburban household on average, emits between 4 and 5 times as much CO2 and, oh, by the way, uses 4 or 5 times as much energy as a walkable urban household.
Wow.
And given the fact that the built environment, our buildings and the transportation system that we use to get around our buildings, emits 73% or more of our CO2 in this country, there's no question that the number one lever we have to deal with climate change is shifting from drivable suburban to walkable urban. That's probably the number one lever that we have.
Cool.
All right. Well, thanks very much. Well, certainly here in, as the caller points out, here in where we live in Champaign-Urbana, there has been growth in the downtowns, particularly Champaign, but also has been increasingly in Urbana. Obviously, developers are seeing the potential here. And, for example, in Champaign, actually a large apartment building was built that has some restaurants on the ground level and then has condos and apartments. And they're now building a second one. And some other buildings like that are going up. So obviously people see potential. Is this, though, do you think, something that where developers have to be persuaded of the potential, either to try to develop something in a, say, a small town downtown, or to look at a big city that already has in place a built environment, and maybe there what you're looking at is just doing some refurbishing and rehab?
Well, rehab actually is more expensive than a new construction in almost all cases. So the cost to redevelop is more than the cost to develop from scratch. But yes, the point you've made is exactly true, that we in the real estate community have to relearn our skill sets. And I liken it to the fact that we in real estate for the last 50, 60 years have learned how to drive a sports car really well. And, you know, we can go right, we can go left, we can go forward at 150 miles an hour. We're really good at driving these sports cars. However, building walkable urban mixed-use places is far more complex. And it's more akin to flying a fighter jet, which is you're going right or left or forward, or going up very fast or crashing and burning very fast and flying at 550 miles per hour. It's an entirely different skill set and far more complex than anything that we're used to. So the development community has a long way to go to learn again how to build these complex, walkable urban places. So they do need to be encouraged. And but one of the assets you have there, of course, is, this, I assume, the sponsor of this radio station, which is the university.
Mm-hmm.
And some of the greatest walkable urban places are around universities. And I've understood that the commercial housing element around the University of Illinois is not exactly to the standard, say, of Madison or Ann Arbor or Boulder. And that's a shame, because it's a great opportunity not just for the real estate development community and for the community at large, but it's also would be fabulous for recruiting to the University of future students, because, again, these young people are demanding this.
Mm-hmm.
The model in this country, one of the first movers in this regard, was the University of Pennsylvania, which sits in West Philadelphia, west of downtown Philadelphia, and it has been a slum for the last 50 years. And as a result, the University of Pennsylvania was at the bottom of the Ivy League as far as students wanting to come there. Well, Judy Rodin was president back in the 90s and decided to focus her attention on, rather than turning her back on the community, embracing the community, and created a very exciting walkable urban place and far more safer around the university. Well, when I was in school in Philadelphia, I once went to a Penn football game, and they were playing Princeton. Princeton cheerleaders came across to do a cheer for the Penn students, and the cheer went, fall back, school, referring to Penn's low standing in the Ivy Leagues educationally. Well, today Penn's number 5 in the U.S. News and World Ranking. And it's my contention that primarily the reason for that is that it can now attract students so that the parents of an 18-year-old girl are not afraid to send their daughter to West Philadelphia.
Well, let's talk with some other folks here. We're moving into about our last 10 minutes, and I have several callers, and we'll talk with someone in Terre Haute over there in Indiana, line number 4. Hello.
Hi there. I have a short 2-part question. I've had a lot of friends from Europe over the years, and they always say, gosh, Americans drive so much. And my response to this is, well, it's because we're so spread out, I mean, relative to what I perceive them to have. And my question is, one, is it feasible to implement public transportation at a large scale, given that we do have such large suburban areas? And secondly, how does our urban, suburban, and rural ratio that we have where people are living compare to that of countries in Europe and maybe even around the world? And I will take my answer off air. Thank you.
All right. Thank you.
Great. Good question. The answer is that you cannot serve suburban development with mass transit. It only works at higher density. And so, but again, go back to the concept earlier in the interview that transportation drives development, that just as farmland will never be developed into a suburban housing without roads first being put in place, you cannot develop walkable urban development without the necessary transportation methods to get people around. And so everybody always asks, oh, you know, America's so spread out, we can't build transit. Well, A, if you don't, we're going to be lapped economically because we have a very inefficient system of building the built environment. And again, it's what people want. But also, you build the transit and the development will follow around the rail transit. And it's taking place in cities as dispersed as Denver, Phoenix, Dallas, obviously Portland, Charlotte. These are all towns that 20 years ago, except for Portland, 20 years ago, everybody in those towns would say people in Phoenix only want to drive. Well, now they're opening up their first of 2 lines, and they're seeing an explosion of new development under construction right now along those lines. And it's so it's a build it and they will come with transit. The question about the density of this country versus Europe, obviously we have more land than we know what to do with. We use about 12% of it for our metropolitan areas, but we use it certainly at a much lower density than Europe. I mentioned earlier that the that suburban sprawl is subsidized. And there is one way of demonstrating that, and that is with broadband access. There was a survey done that showed that the U.S., even though we are the inventors of the computer and high-tech and software development worldwide, we have among the lowest access to broadband of all the industrialized nations on the planet. And the reason, according to this study that was in The Economist last month, is because it costs so much more to get broadband access to low-density America than to high-density Europe and Japan and Korea. And so only 40-45% of us have access to broadband, which means that the other 55% are out of luck as far as competing globally. Without broadband access, you cannot compete. And we can't afford to put in that broadband access because it costs so much to wire houses that are spread out at 1 to the acre as opposed to 40 to the acre.
Okay, let's talk with someone in Champaign. This is line 1. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
A couple of comments. One is I'm old enough to, well, I'm 55, and I remember that there used to be, in running through downtown Champaign and Urbana, trolley tracks that didn't go from one end of town to the other. They went from, I think it went from Danville all the way to Havana. It was an electric interurban line. And the reason I bring that up is because the people that live in Mahomet, like the person who called earlier and so forth, in a way, I feel sorry for him, and in a way, I don't feel sorry for him. In that, Henry David Thoreau in Walden pointed out that the things in life you can do without, you control, and the things in life that you cannot do without control you. Well, I often wonder, what are these people thinking who move to these little towns around here and who are therefore entirely dependent upon an automobile to get around? They have no other than walking, you know, say 10 miles into town, which if, you know, if you want to do that, fine, or maybe bicycling the distance. They just have no other alternative, and they find themselves painted into a corner that they put themselves in, and I often wonder, you know, what are they thinking? But I would like to know what the chances are. What do you know about, or perhaps you could speak about bringing back resurgence, perhaps, of a light rail system. There's a proposition before the Champaign City Council to build a light rail system from downtown Champaign to campus town, you know, big deal. I mean, we've got buses that do that already, but there isn't the slightest interest so far anyway in building an urban rail to, say, the satellite towns within, say, a 15-mile radius of the community. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. On the first point, I folks make decisions, and again, this is a free country, and they should be allowed to make those decisions. Up until now, they have really not had much choice. Over the last 50 years, I'm guessing that if you moved to Champaign-Urbana, you would have a choice of, if you wanted an upper middle income house, you'd have a choice of a single family house or take your choice. And if you wanted to go shopping for groceries, you can go to a 1980s strip mall or a 1990s strip mall, take your choice. We have not provided much in the way of choice. And again, people didn't want the choice, but now they do. And if you don't offer it, the sucking sound you will hear will be of the kids leaving Champaign-Urbana and going to Chicago or Washington or some other place where they can have a walkable urban experience. And that's the story of the Midwest, is that these towns, St. Louis and Cincinnati, are losing their young people to Chicago and to other lively, walkable urban towns. So the issue is about providing choice. As far as the transit, I would urge the cities of Champaign and Urbana to explore both light rail and streetcar. Those are two different kinds of technologies. They are being considered in towns throughout the country. And of course, as I said, Europe, Japan, China have lapped us in this regard, and that if you do not put in rail transit, you're basically condemning yourself to a 20th century existence in the 21st century. It would be somewhat akin to in the 1920s if you decided as a city that you were going to bet your economic future on building, you know, horse-drawn carts rather than cars. Well, if you made that bet, you made the wrong bet. Well, today, if you're not putting in place an essential infrastructure, which is rail transit, you're going to be economically crippling yourself in the future, because for some reason, Americans don't like buses. They like rail transit. And there's all sorts of reasons for that. But if you're not considering it, I would urge you to do it for your own economic future.
Very quickly, we'll try to get one last person here. Someone in Muhammad, line two. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Real quick, you did touch on my question earlier. I was going to ask what the influence of the Internet had on decisions on where people would live, and you did touch on that a bit. The other thing is, I do live in Muhammad. I did make a conscious choice of moving from Urbana out here when I retired, a couple years before I retired, because I wanted a larger piece of property, it's an acre, and I can grow a lot of my own food. I'm an organic gardener, all that kind of thing. So there are advantages. But I'm older. Younger people are the ones that I'm seeing want to live in that environment where they're downtown, where the bars are accessible, the restaurants, all of that urban development, renewal urban development is happening. And I guess that's it. Thanks.
Okay, yeah.
Well, the question about the Internet is a very important one, that obviously the Internet, the web, has fundamentally altered our lives. The issue is, of course, how many people can work from home. We're seeing that percentage go up, but it's still far below 10%. And, you know, it's anybody's guess as to whether it's going to be 10% or 15% or 20%. But even those people that are working from home or those people that are working in a cubicle, once they get their eyeballs off the screen, that lonely existence, it's been my experience that the young people are desperate for social interaction, even more so today than they would have been in a 1950s, 1960s office or other kind of work setting. That many of the jobs today are rather isolated. And particularly if you're working from home, you're extremely isolated. And the last thing you want to do is to walk out to your backyard and be continue to be isolated in most cases. Obviously, there are, again, we need to provide choice. But I think that the internet, you're going to find that you may be able to work in hyperspace, but you have to live in the here and now, and you have to touch the dirt someplace.
Yeah. We're going to have to stop. So we need to say thanks to our guest, Christopher Leinberger. He is a professor, practice, and director of the Graduate Real Estate Development Program at University of Michigan. Right now, he's currently a visiting fellow at the Brookings Institution in Washington, D.C. If you're interested in reading more, thinking more about these issues, or learning more about him, he has a very nice website you might want to take a look at. That's cleinberger.com, and his last name is spelled Leinberger, Leinberger. So go to www.cleinberger.com. You can also look at his book, The Option of Urbanism, Investing in a New American Dream, published by Island Press. Professor Leinberger, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And also our thanks to Ed Berkey there on the other end of our connection at Brookings in Washington, D.C.